This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Who are you going to believe? Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who says speculation is not driving the oil markets? Or the oil minister from the United Arab Emirates, who said today oil prices are, in his words now, crazy? Yeah, I'm with him too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. And by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity, online at us.areva.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us today. It's the 10th of June. This one's a Tuesday. The United Arab Emirates is a member of OPEC, so you'd like to think the country's energy minister knows whereof he speaks when he's talking about oil prices. That crazy comment I mentioned came when he was asked about a meeting that Saudi Arabia has proposed, a gathering of oil buyers and sellers later this month to talk about stabilizing the market. The International Energy Agency said today that's already happened, that global demand is actually slowed to a third of what it had been predicting. Whether or not that'll do anything to prices, well, here's Marketplace's Dan Gratch.
Demand is definitely falling in the U.S. The evidence is in grounded airplanes, less driving, falling truck sales. The IEA projects U.S. demand for oil will contract by up to 2.5% this year. In the past, that would have been enough to lower prices. Not anymore, says energy expert Chip Grote with UT Austin.
We were seen as the governor of demand, but clearly China and India and other developing parts of the world have outstripped us as far as impact on global oil and gas supplies. And so for how the future will look, we have to look to them.
The IEA says for prices to go down, we need to reduce demand. That means cutting energy subsidies in emerging countries and keeping taxes in place in the developed world. But supply is a bigger problem. Existing oil fields are drying out, while new ones have yet to come online. And OPEC says it has little spare pumping capacity. Lester Lave is an economist with Carnegie Mellon University.
The overall economy of the United States has been shaped for 100 years by inexpensive and declining fossil fuel prices. That era is over.
Lave says it would be easy for the U.S. to put pressure on China and India to cut back on their oil consumption. But he says we need to put our own house in order, too.
We're the 800-pound gorilla in the room, or rather, we are the 5-mile-per-gallon Hummer that is consuming the world's petroleum.
Lave says overcoming the current oil shock will require Americans to make wholesale lifestyle changes, and more than likely, take a lot of short-term pain. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Nobody knows short-term pain like the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of the United States. It's his job to figure out what ails the economy and then try to do something about it, no matter how much it hurts. In a speech last night, Ben Bernanke made it crystal clear what's keeping him up at night. No big surprise there. It's inflation the same as it's been for a couple of years now. But economist Diane Swank at Mesirow Financial points out that Bernanke's being more open than usual about what's on his mind.
He even mentioned in his speech that more research needs to be done on what the Fed says in relation to their actions. I think he's kind of running his own little test here to see exactly what the reaction is, to see if he can get financial markets more in line with where he thinks things like the dollar should be.
On the topic of recession, by the way, Bernanke still doesn't think it's going to happen. Tomato growers in Florida got the all clear from the Food and Drug Administration today. The FDA said the Sunshine State's $40 million tomato crop can go to market, even as the government's trying to track down the cause of what is now a 17-state salmonella outbreak. Meanwhile, the Bush administration has asked Congress to boost next year's budget for the agency, an extra $275 million, most of which would go to protecting the food supply. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The Bush administration unveiled a strategy for beefing up the FDA last November, but didn't ask for funding. Now it is. With the money, the FDA would hire nearly 500 new inspectors and set up offices in Asia and Latin America, where food destined for U.S. kitchens can be checked before it's shipped here. The administration is also calling for the FDA to certify third-party inspectors to supplement the work of government employees. This budget request follows numerous recalls of contaminated vegetables, pet food, even toothpaste.
We've got a system that's been in trouble for a long time, and it needs to be rebuilt.
Michael Taylor is a former deputy commissioner at the FDA and now teaches at George Washington University. He calls the $275 million for next year a step in the right direction, but only a step. He supports efforts by a group of senators to add that much immediately to this year's budget, to start restoring faith in the nation's food supply.
And that's part of the real shame here, is we don't want people to stop eating tomatoes or leafy green vegetables, but questions about the safety of the product, loss of confidence in the safety of the food and in the government oversight is very much a deterrent for people making healthy food choices.
Lax oversight, he says, is also closing U.S. export markets. The European Union limits U.S. chicken sales over health concerns, and South Korean anxiety over mad cow-tainted beef from the U.S. has spawned huge protests that threaten to bring down the government. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Shares of the Ford Motor Company fell almost 4% today. That'll put a dent in the wallet of billionaire investor Kirk Kerkorian. Kerkorian has been loading up on Ford stock. He said he's willing to buy as many as 20 million shares. So here's a commentary on investor confidence in the Big Blue Oval. Kerkorian has been offered more than a billion shares to buy. That is, from Ford shareholders who don't necessarily want to be shareholders anymore. Otherwise, on Wall Street today, kind of quiet. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you had to pick one word to define the whole subprime debacle, you could do worse than this. Bonds. People have been throwing around phrases like mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations for the better part of a year now, but it'd be easier just to call them what they are. Bonds. Fancy ones, but fundamentally just promises to return capital to investors, plus a little bit of interest. As we all know by now, though, that is not what's been happening. And so the companies whose job it is to rate the quality of those bonds have been taking all kinds of heat for their role in the credit crunch. Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch are the big three. They're working on a deal with the New York Attorney General aimed at limiting conflicts of interest. The Securities and Exchange Commission is going to take a crack at reforming them. And the agencies themselves are working overtime to repair their reputations, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
If anyone knows the value of reputation, it's folks in the restaurant business, where a bad review or health inspection can shut a place down. At Waterstone Grill in New York's financial district, executive chef Chad Tibbetts serves seafood dishes like grilled salmon with mango chutney. So if your menu said wild Alaskan salmon and it turned out to be farm-raised and people found out about that, do you think that could affect the restaurant's business?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, then they call into question everything on the menu. Is it really, you know, is it really beef? I don't sugarcoat anything on the menu. Some chefs might, but, you know, I keep it real.
The credit rating agencies didn't keep it real. On their menus, toxic pools of subprime mortgages looked as tasty as AAA Treasury bonds. Just around the corner from Chad Tibbetts' restaurant, Standard & Poor's is scrambling to set things right.
We are talking to pension funds, chief investment officers, asset managers, central banks, ministers of finance, lots of regulators, and we're talking to the Hill. We go down to Washington. We talk to parliaments.
Vicky Tillman is head of rating services at S&P. The company has drawn up a 27-point plan to restore faith in its debt ratings. Tillman spoke to me just before she flew to Australia to make her pitch to that country's treasury.
We believe that we need not only to talk and clarify our position, but we need to hear from them in terms of, do you think what we're doing is really going to work for you? How are we doing?
The plan addresses some criticisms that the agencies got too cozy with the companies whose bonds they rated and that their methods failed to detect risks in the subprime mortgage market. Now, analysts will rotate every 5 years. S&P will hire an ombudsman and an outside firm to keep an eye on its practices. Fitch and Moody's have taken some steps of their own. Sylvan Raines has worked for both S&P and Moody's. He's now a consultant. Raines says these efforts are all window dressing.
A reputation is like a virginity. Once you lose it, it does not come back. This is what rating agencies have to understand. If they come back in some form, they will basically have lost most of their power.
But how important is reputation really? The ratings agencies have been tarnished before. Moody's, S&P, and Fitch failed to foresee the collapse of Enron and WorldCom. Fingers were pointed. Congress held hearings.
And after those events, actually, the ratings business thrived.
Jerome Fons would know. He's former head of credit policy at Moody's. Fons says regulations ensure a steady stream of business flows to the rating agencies. Many institutions, like pension funds and insurance companies, can only buy bonds if they've been rated by a so-called nationally recognized statistical rating organization. So Fons says bond issuers have no choice but to hire the agencies to rate their debt.
Because of regulation, I don't think reputation is that important. They have the regulatory license, therefore they're already, if you will, sanctioned.
That sanction may be in jeopardy now that the agencies have attracted the ire of regulators worldwide. The SEC is reconsidering its own rules requiring the use of ratings. The commission also wants to rein in conflicts of interest in the business, and it may propose a separate rating scale for more complex bonds like mortgage-backed securities. After months of investigating, the commission is expected to propose reforms tomorrow. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Given the way the U.S. banking industry's gone over the past year or so, down mostly, there's a tendency to talk about it as if it were a single organism. Of course, that's not the case. For every Bear Stearns, there's a J.P. Morgan, which is a kind way of saying for every loser, there's a winner.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, John Stumpf, the CEO of Wells Fargo. It's one of the few banks that have managed to make it through the past year without enormous losses. When I sat down with him last week in San Francisco, I wanted to talk about a decision he made last July, not long after he got the top job. Stumpf pulled Wells Fargo out of the subprime mortgage market, said it was too risky. So I asked him what he knew, just as the subprime mess was heating up, that nobody else on Wall Street seems to have realized.
We never participated in some of the real exotic things that the industry and others participated in. For example, we never understood why it made sense to make someone a loan so you would owe more in the home later than what you started with. That didn't seem sensible to us.
So when you had conversations with some of your peers, like Ken Lewis at Bank of America and people who are running big banks in this country, did you say, what are you guys thinking?
Well, I didn't have any of those kind of conversations. We're busy enough working on our own things, and others can do what they choose to do. And let me be clear about this. We didn't do everything right. I wish I could say that everything that Wells Fargo did was the right thing. In hindsight, we made some loans on home equity that we should not have done.
What are your thoughts on the use of public money in relieving the mortgage crisis? There's bills going through Congress. The White House is working on some things.
I think that's really an interesting issue. I have a general aversion to using public money, our citizens' money, to bail out problems for a particular sector. Why then shouldn't we bail out problems for people who lose money in the stock market and other industries? So if people did things improper, those lenders should be held accountable. But to use public money, I don't know where that thing stops. Because if you say, well, if your house is underwater and you're past due, you get helped out. How about if you're underwater and you're current? I mean, where do you stop this situation? In a capitalistic system, those who fly too close to the sun get burned. And it's a tough way to say it, but that's what happens.
The logical follow-on question then, when you're talking about sacrificing one to save the many, is Bear Stearns and the Fed's backed bailout of that investment bank.
Now, that's a bit of a different situation.
Absolutely.
And let me tell you why I think it's different. Today, companies have so much counterparty risk.
Explain that.
And what that means is when one company does business with another company, they're buying and selling swaps, transactions, assets, investments, and so forth. They're doing it on the credit and faith of their counterparty. If you pull one party out of the chain, the whole fence could fall. And I think that was a situation where the Treasury and the Fed came together and said, this one is too important for the entire industry because of those counterparty transactions. And the pain from that is more painful than the investment to keep that up.
Were you in on the conference calls that weekend?
We don't comment on that. Nice try.
Let's try a different tack. What'd you think when you first heard about it?
I thought that the Treasury and the Fed did the right deal, and I think that it was helpful for this country and for this industry to have it work out the way it did.
Last time you guys reported quarterly profits, it was not great news, but it wasn't terrible news, and it was greeted with a sense of relief. What does it tell you about the health of this industry when no bad news equals good news?
Well, I think we actually had a pretty good first quarter. We actually had a 17% return on equity.
And you're making money, and that's all well and good. But basically, the gist was, no skeletons in that closet.
Well, these are tough times. I mean, these are times where we have strong headwinds, and we're at the upper end of the credit loss cycle. And in our company's case, to be able to not only pay for the credit hits we took, we actually added money to our retained earnings, I think does suggest that Wells Fargo is different from everybody else.
Do you see the subprime crisis as a business opportunity for you to get market share?
It's an opportunity in this sense. Take it, for example, on the mortgage side, where that's where subprime is really based. Many of the mortgage originators who lived on the subprime spreads are now gone. We always had been a big prime originator. So there's actually good margins in that business, better margins today. We're getting paid for the work we do. So yes, we are getting chances at new business that we've not had before. Secondly, some of the problems in the industry that have hurt these other banks, competitors, have caused them not to have capacity to make loans in other areas of the bank. So we're winning new commercial customers and customers unrelated to mortgage because their banks can no longer serve them.
John Stumpf is the president and CEO of Wells Fargo. Mr. Stumpf, thanks a lot for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
There is more of my chat with John Stumpf and conversations from other corner offices at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, raw milk's raw deal.
Would you have your child go ahead and suckle on a cow teat that had just been rolling around inside the pasture? I mean, common sense says no.
But first, let's do the numbers. Bernanke says it must be true. So inflation worries kept a lid on stocks today. The Dow Industrials gained 9 points, just under a tenth of 1%, to close at 12,289. The Nasdaq fell 10 points, 0.4%, to end at 2448. The S&P 500 lost 3 points, 0.25%, to close at 1358. Investors snapped up stock in companies they think can generate steady profits today. Coca-Cola bubbled over 3.8% after Deutsche Bank upgraded the company. Some financial stocks came back swinging. Citigroup rallied 3.33%. American International Group, JPMorgan Chase, and MBIA each gained more than 2% today. Wachovia climbed 4.6%, and Washington Mutual rose nearly 7%. Apple blossomed 2.2%. As we told you yesterday, the company introduced a new version of its iPhone yesterday. Also, it didn't hurt that both Lehman and Citigroup raised their price targets on that stock. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Treasury Department reports on the federal budget for May. Spyware, annoying and potentially harmful. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee examines its impact on consumers and businesses. And providing more opportunities to get voted off TV, American Idol premiered on June 11th, 2002. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The floods that have been hitting the Midwest this week are threatening to push already high food prices even higher. Today, the Department of Agriculture lowered its already low guess for the size of this year's corn crop by 3%. Short supplies of some crops have contributed to food prices rising at twice the rate of inflation, which sounds bad, and in absolute terms it is. But commentator and economist Tyler Cowen says we'll adapt.
We all know that food prices are rising fast. As a result, people are cutting back on their food expenditures. They're buying fewer luxuries and eating at home more often. That's the shorter-run trend. But here's what's less commonly understood. In the longer run, organic food, luxury foods, and fancy restaurants will do just fine. The economic logic is this. If all food becomes more expensive, what originally looked expensive suddenly appears cheap in relative terms. Consider a simple example. If food costs nothing to transport, say cheap milk would be $2 and organic milk would be $4. The organic milk costs twice as much. Now add on a $2 transport cost to each item. The price comparison is then $6 to $4. The organic milk seems only a little more expensive. If you're going to buy milk in any case, you might even switch to the organic product. Of course, at first people are horrified by the higher prices. They cut back on food costs across the board, as we've been seeing. We're also in the middle of a recession, and that won't last forever. Over time, people will get used to the general idea that food costs so much. They'll start to think about spending more for the organic milk, because, in relative terms, it doesn't seem so outrageously high. Wealthier families in particular will turn away from Safeway and look toward Whole Foods. Economists refer to this result as the Alshian and Allen theorem, named after its two founders, Armin Alshian and William Allen, both formerly economists at UCLA. There's a lot of evidence that the theorem describes actual consumer behavior. It also explains why people tend to spend more when they're on vacation, because it's not worth flying across the country to eat at McDonald's. So if food costs stay high, for a lot of people, the future will be fresh pasta, caviar, and organic tomatoes, not plain oatmeal and a can of beans.
Tyler Cowen is a professor of economics at George Mason University. His latest book is called Discover Your Inner Economist. Let your inner economist out and tell us what it's saying. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Tyler Cowen was talking about organic milk and how it costs more, but consumers eventually get used to it. Try getting used to this. Milk at $12 a gallon. That's what you'll pay to get milk raw, straight from the cow to your refrigerator, no pasteurization provided. Sasha Coca reports.
Okay, well, come back in here.
In the Eden family's kitchen in Clovis, California, 3-year-old Emma is holding up her sippy cup. Her mom, Linda, shakes a jug of raw milk and pours it for her.
Shake it really good.
Emma started drinking raw milk as an infant after Linda couldn't produce enough breast milk.
And I knew if breast milk is all natural, there has to be another all-natural way to feed your baby. She thrived on it.
Eden and other raw milk advocates say it has helpful bacteria and enzymes that aid digestion and boost the immune system. Eden claims it's even helped cure her own asthma. The milk the Edens drink comes from Organic Pastures Dairy in California's Central Valley.
Come on, girls. One at a time.
Mark McAfee and his crew call the cows from lush fields of organic alfalfa into the milking barn. Then, just like at most conventional dairies, they clean the udders with iodine and hook them to a milking machine. The difference is this milk is immediately chilled and bottled, not heated like pasteurized milk.
Mankind's design is lots and lots of milk, super, super cheap, long shelf life, no liability. We have a sterilized immune system that reflects it. People that get on raw milk start seeing a really, really profound difference in their immune systems. But their gut starts to work, their immune system starts to work.
McAfee is a former paramedic turned dairyman who says his sales are growing by $1 million a year. Organic Pastures milk is sold in more than 300 stores in California, including Whole Foods. But it's illegal to sell raw milk in about 24 other states, so some consumers in states like Iowa and Tennessee have turned to the black market or to a cow share, where they own part of a cow rather than paying directly for the raw milk. The FDA says drinking raw milk is like playing Russian roulette with your health. Dr. Michael Payne agrees. He's with the Western Institute for Food Safety and Security.
The dirtier the milk, the more likely it is to be dangerous.
Payne dismisses the notion that there's healthy bacteria in a cow's udder. He says any bacteria introduced in milk comes from milking equipment, dirt, or manure.
Would you have your child go ahead and suckle on a cow teat that had just been rolling around inside the pasture? I mean, common sense says no.
In fact, two Southern California families are suing Organic Pastures Dairy, alleging their children experienced E. coli-related kidney failure from drinking raw milk. Back in her Clovis kitchen, Linda Eden isn't fazed by the arguments against raw milk. She wants the right to choose what to feed her children.
It's not, illegal drugs. It's milk.
Eden may think the government has better things to regulate, but the feds and state agriculture officials are increasingly cracking down on the raw milk trade. California has a new law limiting the amount of bacteria in unpasteurized milk. Producers like Organic Pastures Dairy say that might ultimately put them out of business. From Fresno, I'm Sasha Coca for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note for you today, former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer is back in the news. Spitzer, as you know, resigned a couple of months ago after being caught up in a prostitution ring. He has now apparently set his sights on high finance. The New York Sun reports today that Spitzer's talking to people about a vulture fund. Those are investment pools that go after what are called distressed assets. The assets in question here are real estate. Spitzer's apparently been talking to labor groups about investing their pension funds, the paper says. Returns can be hefty, 20% or more. But if you're wondering how he went from politics to that kind of profit, it does kind of make sense. His dad runs a big real estate firm up in New York City. And that is Marketplace from American Public Radio on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow rose 9 points, just under 0.1%. The NASDAQ dipped 10 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 lost 3 points. That's 0.25% there. Our morning program, the Marketplace Morning Report, is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, cities debate the dream of universal broadband.
Internet access is becoming something that's being seen as a birthright. Wi-Fi stands for this kind of unfettered, very American form of we can have anything we want where we want it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.